Well, hello there. Welcome back to the Producer Joe Show. I am joined today by a really fun radio guy who I know a lot of people in the radio industry have a ton of respect for. This is Rick Jackson. Rick was in San Diego for a while, and he'll tell his story, but he also has a show that goes nationwide or maybe even globally. And I listen to it every weekend. And before I get any further, oh yes, please, if you're not subscribed already, please subscribe to the YouTube channel. Just trying to bring those numbers up so we can do better shows, more shows. And so here we go. I'm going to bring Rick in. And hi, Rick.
Howdy!
I love it.
That's our mini Pearl Open. How you doing, Joe?
I love it. Where's your price tag?
Well, you know what? I met her one time at the Country Radio Seminar. I'm sure you've been there. And she was there, and I saw her, just a couple of years before she passed away. But she had a long speech for us, about how to handle artists and, how to be respectful to country music. And I'll never forget her for that. She was a librarian and an educated woman, in spite of her, her price tag hat and her courty disposition. She was a very bright woman. And so out of respect for her, that's how we open the show every week.
I love that. And I do listen every weekend. We both listen. My wife, Amy, and I listen. It's just a fantastic show. We'll get more into that in a minute. But tell me about your start here. It was in the 70s, right, Rick?
Yeah, it was just like, for anyone watching, it's just I started on the local radio station, just like the whatever local radio station you listen to there, and started doing just a regular disc jockey show. And then when Elvis Presley died, and especially after Marty Robbins died, we did a couple of specials for them, and I learned a lot about fans. Fans were just devastated by losing those two people, and they would call by the hundreds, by the thousands, just looking for a connection, a community connection. And so that our radio station at KERE at that time was that, and then when Marty Robbins died, I was with KYGO in Denver, which was just inducted in the what's equivalent to the Radio Hall of Fame. They were named a legendary radio station. There's only been 30 of those. So it's a pretty special radio station. So I got my start there, and we decided that, there was so much passion for Marty, who wasn't really having hits back then. This was 1982 when he died, that we didn't have enough classic stuff on the air. Even back then, didn't have enough. And we were still playing a lot of classic songs, but not enough. There were folks who wanted more. So we created this show called the Sunday Morning Hall of Fame initially, and then later Rick Jackson's Country Classics. But the whole idea was to get those old records out, dust them off, and play them for folks who were really wanting to hear it. And boy, we proved it, because it was an immediate smash. I mean, we threw the needle off right off the Richter scale with our very first ratings period. So we've been at it since then, since 1984, I think was the first time that we did that show. And I've been hosting it ever since.
It's fantastic. I mean, like I said, in my opinion, it's the best show on radio all week. And it's not just the music, because to me, that was the best music of the genre.
Well,
but
wow.
It's your stories behind the scenes and everything else that you tell about the artists, or even about the songs, or how you've met them. And while I'm thinking of it, because aforementioned, I do have ADHD. Let's not get too far away from this. A few weeks ago, you mentioned,
be a great pair. You'll ask me a question, and I'll think of something and answer something else.
Well, that's kind of how my life is. I just kind of jump all around. A few weeks ago, you mentioned a story before you played the Judds, and you mentioned their ascent to stardom. Can you give us that story one more time, and how quickly they were just able to start and just go?
Yeah, sometimes you forget, a lot of these people pay their dues coming up through honky-tonks. And I don't think that Naomi wanted that for her kids. She didn't want that to be a part of her life. And so she didn't really have that kind of experience of getting up on stage and getting in front of a crowd and having a good time and figuring out what works and learning how the stage works and the lights and all that kind of stuff. It's a craft, and it takes a little while to learn that. You know, Garth Brooks is the carbon, you know, he's the king of that because he understood the stage so well and how to perform well live. But they had never done that. They did that at church and on their back porch in Kentucky. And literally, they plucked them off that back porch in Kentucky and put them on the CMA Awards show and, you know, traveling with big stars right away. And they were scared to death. I kid you not. And the first time I met them, and there's a funny story behind this, too. The RCA representative had brought this mother-daughter team into town. I'd never heard of them. They were called the Judds, but no one at that point knew who they were. And he wanted me to come to a showcase at a hotel room, not in a big room, but a hotel room. And this made me uncomfortable. I decided not to go. So the next day, he brought them into the office when I was working at KYGO and said, here's what you missed last night. And they sat down and just blew me away. I knew I'd made the biggest mistake of my career. It still is when it just comes to, you know, making a bonehead decision. And I knew right away I'd made a big mistake. But in spite of that, we became pretty good friends over the years and had lunch and that kind of thing. But, you know, I remember watching them early in their career, and they were so uncomfortable on stage, and I really felt sorry for them. And I kind of felt that way about Randy Travis early on, too. You forget that, you know, some of these people were just, you know, Randy was cooking catfish before they put him on, you know, the big time Warner Brothers records. And he, of course, right out of the box, he had a number one song with On the Other Hand. Sure. So it's tough for those folks. And I felt sorry for them for their first few years because it was uncomfortable for them on stage. They finally obviously got it together. And the music was always there. Their music was always flat out the best you could possibly expect from anybody. But their performance standards were, it was a little tough for them for a while. And Naomi admitted it. She said, we're not ready for this. I am not ready for this. And I said, I know, nobody ever is, but you get up and do it anyway. And they did. And of course, they were fantastic throughout the entire decade of the 1980s.
Yeah, they, man, they were great. What a fun group to listen to. And certainly sad on the tail end here.
And they fought like cats and dogs, those two. Wynonna and Naomi were just, they were on each other's nerves all the time. I had lunch with them a couple times, and one time Wynonna just got up and left. And then the next day I saw them because I was emceeing their show, and Naomi came up to apologize to me. And I, you know, that's the last thing I ever needed to hear from her. Because I understand, you know, nerves can, you know, you get your, you're with your mom and you just grew up. She was 19 years old when this all started for her. And she really had a chance to grow up, and now she's stuck with her mom all the time, and she wasn't happy about it. So they were constantly kind of biting on each other, in spite of the fact that they loved each other all the time, of course. And on stage, that you never showed up, but there were times when I was with them, it was pretty tight.
Do you think any of the contentious relationship was to maybe try to get them better? Maybe Naomi was trying to.
Hey, you know, it's just a mom and daughter. Moms and daughters know, you know, you get on each other's nerves. Family gets on your nerves. You know, yeah. No one gets on your nerves like family does. And then when you're stuck in a bus with them 24 hours a day, sometimes for, you know, 3 months, 4 months in a row, sometimes 6 months. You know, some of these artists, when they, Mo Bandy told me one time he was on the road for 311 days out of 352 in the year. That's a lot of time with whoever you're spending that time with. And if it's your mom and you're 19 years old, nerves can get crackly.
Well, this story may not go anywhere really, but again, my ADHD, you mentioned Mo Bandy, and I remembered my dad's the one that got me into classic country because he would always watch the Westerns and he would always be having music on in the backyard. You mentioned Mo Bandy, and I remember he had this cassette tape he would always play, and then I would always play. It had Mo Bandy on there, but it also had Vern Gosden on it. And me and Amy were driving home from Disneyland one day, and we were listening to your show. And you played Vern, and I go, oh, it's Vern Gosden. And she goes, how? I'm like, you know, these songs, these artists, they just stick in your head more so than I think a lot of others do. And I think a lot of that is because of the storytelling in country music. It's unlike any other genre, in my opinion. The storytelling is what makes it. So that obviously planted a seed in my head. And I mean, I look good in front of my wife finally, you know, so that was cool. Got a little bonus point there. But yeah. But your show,
well, you know, and your story about your father, you know, that I think that's a big part of it too. Because it is a it's a family. I consider the people that listen to this show and the people that truly love country music family people. I really do. I don't just say that. I think the people that love country music have a certain understanding of what's important in life. And I think we have a lot of the same values, the people that love this music. And so you're just kind of bonded already. And your story about your dad and Mo Bandy, and my story was with my dad and Johnny Cash. I mean, I remember holding the board while he was sawing away to Ring of Fire. I remember that. I remember he was listening to KLAK, which was a big station in Colorado. And when I was growing up, I hated it. I couldn't understand what he liked about that. And of course, it all came rushing back when I got to an age where I understood it more. And then, of course, it just thrust myself into it head to toe with my career. But it's, you know, I feel it with my dad's family, and the people that grew up with that music and understand it, and all of the lyrics that speak to our life and our lifestyle. And the story about your dad that resonates with me. And Mo Bandy. Yeah.
He loved Roy Rogers, you know, and Johnny Cash. And I thank him forever. He's gone now, but I thank him forever for instilling that in me, because it's just, it makes you think, and it's not just do, 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 do. It's actually lyrics that, I mean, even if it's not a song, Johnny Cash's, the song about the flag, where it's basically spoken lyric.
Yeah. Ragged old flag.
Ragged old flag. I mean, it's just powerful, you know, but
yeah. And you hear that, and you can't help but think of your father when you hear, I can't help but think of my dad when I hear a Johnny Cash song. And all this old stuff brings him back to me a lot. My mom was a big fan of music too. Not as much the country music, although she liked the pop stuff. She loved Islands in the Stream with Kenny Rogers and Dolly Parton. She'd go crazy over that. But my dad was the one who had the background. Grew up in Arkansas. You know, he was a sharecropper's son. He knew that life. He knew what Loretta Lynn knew. And he passed that on to me, even if I didn't live that life, I knew about his life, and these songs come back and inform me about that. And I get closer to him every time I hear a song.
Well, you mentioned Dolly Parton, and look at that. Got Dolly Parton right on there.
Yeah, that's my kids, Kelly and Jen, and that's Dolly. Way back when, that must have been 1984, 83. I emceed the Kenny and Dolly show at McNichols Arena when it was still around in Denver, Colorado. Boy, that was a great show.
You know, there's a few artists that I regret not seeing live. I was able to catch Kenny Rogers up here at the Belly Up years back, and I'm so glad that I did, because there's just certain bands that, dang it, I should have seen them. Dang it, I should have, you know, and I saw Kenny, and I was so happy about it. And on that note, I don't think it's coming past yet, but Winona is coming to this town soon. So I keep thinking I want to go to that, but artists I don't want to miss.
You're pretty close there to Stagecoach. Have you been to Stagecoach?
I did go about 7 years ago. Yep.
So I went there 1 year when I was managing KSON, and Kenny was on the secondary stage, Kenny Rogers.
Yeah.
So, you know, because his career had passed, and I guess, you know, they wanted only the up and comers and the people that were stars of today on that main stage. Well, and I like Sheryl Crow. I think Sheryl Crow is a terrific artist. She had one of my favorite albums here recently, but she was on stage on the big stage, and Kenny was on the one that held about, I don't know, 2,000 people, and she was, you know, she could have been in front of 20 or 30 on the big stage, and nobody was there for Sheryl Crow. They were all watching Kenny Rogers. It had overflown all the, you know, out of the place where they were supposed to be watching, and into the aisles and back into the main part of the arena to see Kenny Rogers. And it gives you an idea of, you know, how much those songs stick with people. And a lot of them, I don't think, were even alive when he recorded tunes like Lucille or The Gambler and that kind of thing. But they sure knew them, and they were singing right along. It was really kind of heartwarming. I felt sorry for Cheryl, but it was such a great thing to see Kenny Rogers still resonating, you know, years after he'd had his last hit record.
Hey, it's storytelling, man. I'm telling, that's a big part of it. And yeah. I looked up when I did go to Stagecoach, and it was a little bit more than 7 years ago. It was actually April 26, 2013. And that was actually the day that George Jones passed away. And I remember being in a trailer and going, ah, you know, and, but same day.
Yeah, that was not a good day.
No.
Yeah. You know, when any of these people pass, like George, I do find a lot of happiness in the fact that I can at least, you know, put, you know, give our listeners a good review of what their career was like and the stories that made them who they were. And that's a nice thing to be able to do. And so it's heartening for me, but boy, it's just, it kills me when someone like that goes. Toby Keith dying for some reason just really, really hurt. That was just, I had trouble with that show. I had to do a lot of retakes in that show.
Rick, I could tell. I remember listening to that show and I could feel your emotion through the speaker. I know that was a tough one for you.
Yeah, it was. I didn't think that was, you know, I really thought he was going to recover. And, you know, he had done a show just the night before.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, and so you're thinking, well, you know, he's doing all right. And he kept telling us he was all right. But, of course, he wasn't. And the day that that happened, it was just, you know, it's always a shock. But that one was a tough one.
We mentioned George Jones, and we watched that, what is it, a biopic, I guess, a couple months ago. That was a really good movie. We really enjoyed that one. And
have you seen the one about the one that's on Netflix of George and Tammy?
I think that's the one I'm referring to.
Oh my God. I thought that was absolutely terrific. I even, you know, I thought, boy, this is really going to be tough I can't remember the guy's name who played George Jones' part, but, you know, trying to recreate George Jones singing any song, it's impossible. But I thought he did a credible job of creating his own kind of nuance. It wasn't George for sure. But he did a credible job of that. And of course, you know, I thought both actors were terrific. And I thought the series was, I watched it. I bet I've watched that 4 or 5 times now. I thought it was terrific.
Yeah, that's exactly the one I'm talking about. His name is Michael Shannon. And now that I know more about him, I'm seeing him on a lot more things. And he is a tremendous actor. And he really, like you said, he really portrayed George quite well in that.
Yeah, I thought so too. Yeah, it was. I got all excited about that. After the first episode of that series, I thought, this is going to be fun. And it was. It was a great rip.
Yeah, if you viewers haven't seen it, you got to check it out. It's fantastic. And it's really good. I mean, I thought Walk the Line was great with Joaquin Phoenix. I thought he embodied, and I mean, Reese Witherspoon did too. Those are two really great movies covering these artists.
I had a friend that wasn't much of a country fan who's, you know, I recommended that he watch it if you want to learn something about it. I remember going back to me, he said, well, he was a scoundrel. I don't know if I like him or not. And I said, yeah, he was. He was definitely a scoundrel.
And
but
there's a lot of
boy
those.
Could sing.
Yeah, he could sing. I do want to watch the Kris Kristofferson. There is one on that one, but there's some really good movies out there that portray that.
Well, you can't beat the stories, you know. It's just like Coal Miner's Daughter or Sweet Dreams. I mean, those stories, you know, you just can't not enjoy the storytelling that goes on when you're talking about Patsy Cline and her tragic death or Loretta Lynn's upbringing, which really wasn't unlike that of Dolly or Johnny Cash and so many people from that era.
Yeah.
You know, Willie, who lost his mom and dad and was raised by, you know, by in-laws, along with his sister Bonnie. It's, you know, the stories are tremendous. I mean, it's one of my favorite things about the format is that these people came from such desperate conditions. Which is why I think this great thing still happening, even with Post Malone, even with Jelly Roll, even with these new people, something that has been handed down and it's still being respected, many pearls are reminding me of this now, be respectful, remember your past, is that they will stay and they will sign autographs until you get yours. All of them. And you don't see that in rock and roll. You don't see that in pop music. You see it with some, but you don't see it with everybody. And in country music, always, every one of them, they'll stay. Reba McEntire one time played a little honky tonk and her career was going along pretty good. She packed that place. And she probably was too big for it, but she stayed with the deal that she made with the owner. And she showed up and she went, they put her in a coat closet. Huh. And I left at 1 o'clock at night. Her show was long over. And they said she stayed until 2 o'clock in the morning in that coat closet until every person that wanted to talk to her and wanted her autograph got it. And I think that's one of the beautiful things about this format.
I believe that about her. Yeah. Yeah. I failed to mention Glenn Campbell. I have a friend who wrote songs for Glenn Campbell, Glenn Castleberry. And mm-hmm. I want to have him on the show soon, but that's another storyteller. But I guess we could go on about storytellers for quite a while. I think I'll move on. We could probably talk for hours on this.
Yeah, we could.
I could imagine you and I sitting around a campfire talking about
we'd never sleep
for hours, man. Seriously. Yeah. But yeah. You sent me some pictures, and I'm going to scroll through them right now, if you don't mind. Okay. I'm going to try to guess them right off the bat, and then maybe you can tell me a short something about each one.
Okay. Patty. Boy, there's a singer. Yeah. I don't know if there's ever been a singer more George, like George Jones. When Patty Loveless sings, I don't care what she's singing, it's country. And it's just lovely. I mean, she had just the greatest voice, and she was such a great person. I only met her once. I went to lunch with her at a Mexican food restaurant. She needed a bite because she was nervous. And I thought, she's nervous. She's the star. But you forget these are just common people, and they're not accustomed to being, run around. And this was pretty early in her career, too.
You mentioned Reba McEntire. I was working at KSON when Reba's plane crashed down in Otay Mesa, and it was just tragic. We had a big card made for her, and all the fans signed it, but you mentioned Reba, and we just have a lot of respect for her, and we love all of her work.
She's terrific. She's something else. Ricky Van Shelton.
Boy, I haven't heard that name in a minute.
I didn't get to know Ricky really well. I did a couple of interviews with him, and that's the only time that I had a chance to have some interaction with him. He did tell me, that like John Conley, who was an undertaker, he was a pipe fitter, and he kept his license all those years, just like John Conley did. John Conley still has his license, and as a pipe fitter, he said, I enjoyed it. He said, I was good at it, and I made a good living. I enjoyed the people I worked with. But boy, that guy was so smooth, wasn't he? What a voice he had.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's see here.
That's Highway 101. That was a group that was managed by another guy from Denver, Chuck Morris. And so because Chuck was from the same town I was in, from 1980 until 1992, I was in Denver at KYGO Radio. I was a program director and the morning show host for those years. And Chuck would bring by, he was managing Lyle Lovett, Highway 101, and the star of the show, the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. And we got a lot of time with those folks, and they recorded a lot of their material up in Caribou Ranch, which isn't too far outside of Denver. It's about 45 minutes to the west. And so we had a lot of interaction with them. Unfortunately, that group was just killing it, and Paulette Carlson quit, and it destroyed her career and theirs too.
Ouch. Dang.
Yeah. And the Dirt Band.
Yeah.
And boy, the folks who like Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, because that sold 8 million copies. That's a copycat of what the Dirt Band did first, which was to bring in Roy Acuff and Johnny Cash and all of these older stars and put them together with the Longhairs to prove that they could make great music together. And I think it was 1970 when they did the first Circle album. And that first Circle album sold a million copies eventually. It wasn't the first one to sell a million copies. That was the Outlaw album with Waylon Willie and Jesse and Tom Paul. But that album came out earlier and actually eventually did sell a million copies. And it's kind of what I think T-Bone Burnett did with Oh Brother, We're Out There, that put that great soundtrack together.
Yeah.
That surprised everybody and sold 8 million copies, which that's a lot of records. But this one did really well, too. And it was a spectacular union of two different generations that proved they were family and could make family music together and harmonize together, respect one another, and put together an album that was just exceptional.
Yeah, that's a great group. I don't know if I'm more surprised about all the hair in the picture or the $2 per night movie rentals in the back there.
That's funny. I didn't even notice that. Yeah. That's funny.
Going to the video store, that was fun.
Oh, there they are.
Look at that. What were we talking about?
Yeah, I love those two. They're just, I felt so bad for the hepatitis that took her away from her career with Naomi.
Sure.
And then the way it all ended for her, talk about grieving. Boy, that was just so unexpected. I'll never get over that.
No.
But that was an incredible family. Another story about them, I saw them at the CMA Awards one year, and they brought their sister. And at that point, she wasn't a big movie star, even though she'd been on a lot of magazine covers. But she was 17 years old. And when she walked down to that stage and Naomi introduced me to her, literally, there's just no way around it. Your jaw just drops. She was so incredibly beautiful. I mean, that family had some pretty good lookers.
Yeah, I'm guessing that's the 80s, judging by the suspenders and the pink tie.
Oh, yeah, that was probably 1982 or 1983, I would guess.
Well, here's somebody I met while working at KSON. Alan Jackson had an autograph signing in all places in Ramona at a Kmart. Nice guy. Super nice guy.
Oh, he couldn't be nicer. And so low-key, his aw shucks kind of disposition, which make him seem like a country bumpkin, but you're not a country bumpkin when you write a song like Where Were You When the World Stopped Turning? Or Drive, one of my favorite songs ever. I love that song. I think that's just, it's hard to beat that. He's right up there to me with Bob McDill and Chris, for the songwriters who had an intellectual approach. And he didn't always take that with his music, which I think was wise of him. But when you needed to have something from him that had some special wisdom, he had it. And he showed it to us in so many of his songs. I think those two are both good examples. I love that guy. Big guy, too.
I know he has integrity because my wife lived in Nashville two times. And she knew a lot about the industry. And apparently there was the CMAs. And they told Alan that so-and-so couldn't perform. It was just an insult to another performer. So Alan came on live right after that. And he had his drummer not use drumsticks or something. It was a little bit of a middle finger, respecting the other artist, you know.
Yes. Yeah,
he was very defensive of his brethren, but I know. Yeah, yeah, when I met him, super nice guy.
Yes, he's super nice guy, but he's principled, and that gesture for George Jones was pretty special. I felt as good about that as I did about Johnny Cash refusing CBS's request for him to leave out the word high in Sunday Morning Coming Down on his show, because they didn't want him being associated with dope. And of course, he over enunciated that for the show. So they were going to do what they were going to do when they felt right about it, and he felt right about it. And that's Janie Fricke, who was always a reluctant star.
But before we go on, that was me.
There you go. There's your Alan Jackson shot. That's a great shot. He's a pretty special guy.
Without
George Strait. And then that's Janie. And that was also at the Country Radio Seminar, and we used to do interviews there. because everyone gathered for that, including the artists. And Janie didn't really want to be a star. She would tell me that many times over the years, that she was happy being a background singer and doing those McDonald's jingles and all the Coca-Cola stuff that she did. That was just fine with her, or doing backup when someone else was on stage. And when they threw in the spotlight, that voice just came shining through. And I think she won the CMA vocalist twice back in the 1980s when she was having a pretty good string of hits.
Let's see here. Doug Stone.
That's Doug Stone. Yeah. Doug, right in the middle of his career after the songs, you probably know the A Jukebox in a Country Song, mm-hmm. or maybe I'd Be Better Off on a Pine Box.
Pine Box, yep.
His first song. That's Doug Stone. And Doug was just hitting his stride and had a heart attack. And they had some recordings of his, but they weren't planning on releasing them as singles. But until he could recover, they released some I thought was probably material that wasn't quite up to snuff. And it kind of destroyed his career. He had a great voice, and I thought he had a really bright future. And it's some unfortunate timing there.
Yeah, I enjoyed him a lot. Vince Gill? The Eagles, Vince Gill?
Vince Gill, I got to see over and over and over throughout his career. I golfed with him one time. He's a good golfer. I never met anyone more wise than Vince Gill. Look at what he's done in his career. You know, he played with with Ricky Skaggs and Keith Whitley in a bunch of bluegrass groups where they weren't necessarily together in all the groups, but they'd be on stage and they'd pick together. So he started out in the same place that those guys did. Then he went to Pure Prairie League, and he was their lead singer for a while doing pop music. Then he came to country music, killed it, 19 CMA awards, and hosted it for many years. And then he had his own couple of groups that he did in between there that were just for fun because they were great musicians. And now he's with the Eagles and playing with the biggest American band ever and fitting right in and having a great time. So he does session work, both vocal and instrumental. I never saw anybody like him. He can play any instrument on stage. He's an incredible singer. Everyone says he's got the best pitch of anyone in Nashville. And that's saying something. And he could write. He had, I think, 4 songs that won CMA awards for his writing, not even his singing. He's something else. He's as close to Merle Haggard, I think, as almost anybody comes, without the swag. And that's the one thing that he didn't have that Haggard did, Johnny Cash and George Jones all had. He never had that bad boy image. And for whatever reason, the truth is, it kind of enhanced their image. And gave them some kind of a sound also, I think, that was just a little bit more rough-edged than Vince. Vince was pretty smooth.
Well, here's another one. This is the last one. Look at that.
Yeah.
I mean, the large headphones aside, look at who you're standing with.
Yeah, well, you know, that's pretty close to the year he won the Entertainer of the Year Award. And I think that he did that in 1985 or 86. I can't remember which. It was one of those two. And here's another guy, and Ricky Skaggs, and of course, Vince Gill are kind of joined at the hip too, because they're both great players, and Ricky especially so. Although Ricky never really wrote. The one thing that Ricky Skaggs didn't write songs, but boy, could he sing. That high, lonesome sound was so good, and the way he brought those two sounds together between bluegrass and country music and fused them the way that he did, like no one else ever had before. That was pretty groundbreaking stuff. He was exciting. Back in 1981, 2, 3, and 4, there was nobody bigger than Ricky Skaggs.
Yeah, another one that we listen to in the backyard is Steve Martin. When he plays his banjo, here I go going sideways again, but I'm just thinking of sounds that make us happy, you know. And Steve Martin, if anybody can, you know, take a listen to his music. It's really phenomenal.
Yeah. Steve Martin's pretty doggone good, too. His group, the Stone Mountain Rangers or whatever they're called.
Yep.
I got a couple of his albums. He can play, and he's got a great band that he plays with, and he's serious about it. He gets out there, travels, and he says nothing he enjoys more.
Well, my latest kick, and I think Kelly Clarkson brought this to my attention on her show, is Alison Krauss with Robert Plant, and they have a duet going right now that's phenomenal.
I haven't heard that. I'll have to listen to that. Who is she playing with?
Robert Plant.
I'll have to listen to that.
Really a good listen, but I'll send that to you.
Okay.
So two last things that I want to hit on here. It's more of a statement than a question, unless you have something to say on it. So each week is different for you. Each week is a themed show, and it's kind of fun because at the first, I don't want to hear you say everything because I want to try to guess what the theme is before I hear you say what the theme is. So I'm always trying to play a little game with myself. Can I guess what the theme of this week is? And last week's was the biggest hit for every artist. And
the best of the best.
The best of the best. And that was really fun to listen to.
Well, you know, you're not going to have a whole lot of stiff songs in the best of the best. You know, they're all pretty doggone good songs when you're featuring Waylon Jennings and Johnny Cash and Tammy Wynette. So, you know, that's an easy one to put together. But, you know, and it's somewhat surprising, especially someone like George Jones, because I'm sure most people thought it was going to be He Stopped Loving Her Today. But, you know, at the time, George wasn't really hot. And the fact that it hit number one was astonishing because he really hadn't been doing very well. And so I don't really think that the radio industry was kind of ready for it. And I think in retrospect, they realized what a masterpiece it was. And over time, which has always been my thing, over time, you'll find out what the great songs are. Because after 15, 20, 25 years, you'll know what sticks and what doesn't. And of course, of that song, I don't think there's a whole lot of people that argue with the idea that that probably is the best song ever made. And his biggest song, though, his biggest chart record was Tender Years, which, you know, today no one's even heard of. So there were some surprises in there.
The last thing I want to touch on here is that plaque or that photo that's behind you, the Hall of Fame. Can you tell me about it? Behind you, the picture.
You know, I had a friend of mine here in, he's a close friend of mine. He does a lot of woodwork. The actual print that you're seeing on the wall was what we used in Nashville when we used to go there and do live broadcasts. And it was in a bigger set. It had like a cubicle, really, with 10-foot high walls and then lots of pictures of artists and that kind of stuff. And then we'd have people come in and do interviews. And that was part of that set. And so we don't do that anymore because they don't even have an exhibition area, I don't think, anymore for CRS. So we took that down and had him put that together. So, and I enjoyed that. His name is Derek, and he's a good guy. And that's really been our insignia from the beginning. This is what's kind of taken from, if I get that in front of the camera.
Yeah, there it is.
That was sort of our insignia for a long time. And so we used that for that set.
That's a great looking card. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Thanks.
So, I know you were here in San Diego, Denver, Colorado. What other markets have you worked in, Rick?
Just three, Charlotte, Denver, and San Diego. And I spent a good deal of time in almost all of them. The shortest stay was in San Diego. I was only there for about 6 years. In Denver, of course, that's where I grew up. So that's where I was lucky enough to find my first job at a small station there. And then moved into KYGO. And KYGO was brand new when I joined them. Bob Call, who's now in the Country Radio Hall of Fame, was brought in from Charlotte to program KYGO in Denver. And I was the first person he hired to do mornings. So we kind of built that station. I give him credit, not myself, but I was with him as he built that radio station and put it on the map. So we were there right there from the beginning, from what is now a legendary radio station. And that was an awful lot of fun. And then when I got to go to San Diego, ironically, I'd been a general manager for 17 years and never had a country station. I was running a news talk station and an AC station here in town. So it was a thrill to be able to manage KSON, which was already, you know, a legendary station before I got there. So it was just an honor to be able to be a part of that. And you know, it was a great opportunity for us to make our mark. My mark will always be John and Tammy, because we brought John and Tammy in under my reign, and I'm as proud of that as anything I've done in my career. I love those two, and they've done so well there, and I just hope they stay there forever.
Let me tell you something. I've lived in this town my entire life. I probably remember every morning show that was at KSON and maybe all the rest of the stations. John and Tammy are about the two, and producer Steph, let's not forget her, and currently Jessica. Those are some really fantastic people, and how you brought them in, whatever coup you did to bring them in, I thank you. San Diego thanks you. They are really treasures.
Yeah. Well, you know, I give that credit to Kevin Callahan. He's the one that really found them. You know, when you're the general manager, you got to be involved in all the major decisions, and a morning show certainly is. But the moment I met them after Kevin had brought them in, I thought, well, that's it. And the only thing I'll take credit for is telling them, you know, stay here, make your mark here. Don't move around. Don't worry about New York. Don't worry about San Francisco. You'll make a great living. You can own this town. And they've done it. And they did that. And now they do. And now they're respected across the country. Everyone knows who John and Tammy are. And they should, because they're really talented people. And they reflect the values of the country music listener. And, you know, they're so accessible and so friendly and so funny. It's just it was a pleasure being around them.
And they both recently re-signed at KSON, so we're going to have them around for a little while longer.
Amen to that. I love that.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's good news.
I'm going to open the door in a minute, but while I do that, tell me about the difference between the three markets that you've been in. I know they were different formats, but tell me about the three cities that you worked in. I'm a city guy. I like knowing about culture and cities.
Well, you know, Denver and San Diego are just, you know, not even from a radio standpoint, just from perspective of living there. You know, San Diego and Denver are Western towns. I didn't know that really until I moved to Charlotte, that I was a Westerner. But, you know, you've got Southerners and Texans and New Englanders. And I haven't heard that expression used very much, but I realized when I moved to Charlotte that I was a Westerner, because we had just, you know, have a different perspective on life. So it was, living in San Diego was like, that was easy water for me to swim, because I'd been in a Western city before. Like, and people say California is different. I didn't find it that way at all. I found it has a very Western attitude. People like to go outdoors. People like to enjoy the sunshine. They like to enjoy their surroundings. Because the surroundings are so beautiful everywhere in the West, and pick a state, they're all gorgeous. And California is no exception. What a gorgeous place it is. From a radio perspective, they were pretty similar, because they're all pretty similarly sized markets. San Diego was the biggest of the three, and Charlotte, but Charlotte's pretty close. We're approaching 3 million now, and I think Denver's 3.5, maybe 4. But you know, from a radio perspective, I thought they were all great radio markets. I loved Charlotte because I got to work for the big news talk station there, WVT, which is a legendary station and has been there for over 100 years. And that was a real privilege to be able to run that radio station. So that was a big difference just personally for me. But the radio markets were competitive and had great people in all of them. And, you know, I've enjoyed, you know, Iowa's got great radio. So does Sioux City. You know, the truth is there's some great radio talent in small markets. I never was a big market guy, even though I worked in some fairly large markets. Never worried about New York or LA, because I just enjoyed being in the town that I was. And Denver was big enough, and San Diego certainly was, and so was Charlotte.
Right. So I have a question for you, and I need help from my wife on this one, because I mentioned something earlier that I only had half the story on, and I can't let this go without having the rest of the story. So, Rick, this is Amy. This is my wife. We listen to you every week.
Hi.
So, I mentioned earlier the Alan Jackson story and how he was on the CMAs and how he was told. Remember the story?
So, this was years ago when I lived in Nashville, and I've always loved him for this. George Jones was supposed to get an award, or he was up for an award for Song of the Year, and he was supposed to be able to perform his entire song. Mm-hmm. And he was told at the day of the performance that he would not be performing his entire song, which, you know, those guys wrote stories, not just songs. And it was for like NSYNC or Backstreet Boys or somebody. I can't remember who it was at the time. to, because they wanted them on there. And so George Jones says, I'm not doing it. I'm not going to perform. So Alan Jackson went out and started his song, and then he stopped and played the entire George Jones song for him. And I thought that was one of the coolest things that I'd ever seen.
Wasn't it? Yeah, that was one of the coolest moments in the history of that show. The song was called Choices.
Choices, yeah.
And it didn't get a lot of airplay. You know, there's another one, you know, that, you know, George recorded this great song. And at least the industry recognized it, but it didn't get a lot of airplay. I think it only got up to like number 30 on the charts or something like that. It was really disappointing. But it was a great song, so I was so happy that George got that nomination, and I was proud of him for not, for saying no. I'm not gonna sing the shortened version. I've been doing this 50 years. You let the new guy do that. I'm not doing that. Yeah. And so Alan, I love that Alan, right in the middle. I don't remember what song he was singing.
Rock
the Jukebox or something, and then he stopped and went into Choices, and everyone was going, "Yeah, that's fantastic."
Yep, we were all going crazy. Yeah, that was an amazing moment. I lived in Nashville at the time, and I worked at the Longhorn, where a lot of the songwriters and a lot of the artists came in, because we were right on Music Row, and everybody was just like, oh, yes, that was so great. Yeah, it was awesome.
Which Longhorn were you working at? Where is that in town?
Is it still there? I don't even know if it's still there anymore.
Was that downtown, up near Broadway?
Kind of. It was on like 16th, like right there. It was right, you know, so they all came in all the time. So a lot of people that was a big buzz the next day.
God, I got to tell you, you know, when I first started going to Nashville, that was not a great part of town. I think the first trip I took there was 1982. Maybe it was sooner than that. It might have been 79 when I went to Nashville for the first time, pretty close to that. And that was a bad area of town. And in spite of the fact that there was the Ryman and Tootsie's was still there. And of course,
we were up a little farther from there. We were up.
Yeah, but you didn't want to get out of that first block. If you went further than that area, that immediate area, it was pretty tough. And if you look at it now, it looks like Las Vegas.
I know. I moved there in 92, and downtown was still pretty seedy, and I loved it. It was so great. And it was just such a raw, I don't know. It just had a really cool energy about it. And now it's so different. And,
it's a great town. And listen, anybody who's watching right now, if you haven't been to the Country Music Hall of Fame, in your lifetime, if you love country music, you have got to get there at some point, because it is just an amazing place.
Go see the people that are there still, like Manuel and all those guys. I mean, it's just, it's a great town. The whole town is just... just a great. I love it. I gotta take this one there soon.
Yeah, I've never been. I'm interested in meat and three. I guess. Yeah. I'm as a foodie. Yeah.
You gotta go. I mean, you gotta see Ryman. You gotta see the Bluebird Cafe. You have to go all these places.
There's so many places. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm gonna give you guys back the show so I can feed my starving animals. But you know what? I will say we do. We listen to you all the time. You're probably one of the few country music shows that I will listen to, because you actually play country music. So thank you for that, and keeping that genre alive, because I am a huge I love the old country and the western swing and all that good stuff. And thank you for keeping that going, because a lot of people would never hear it if not for people like you. So thanks.
Amen to you. You humbled me. Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
I hope to meet you someday.
All right. I'll see you then.
Thanks, Rick.
You're welcome.
Well, thank Rick, that's the better half, as they say.
All right.
Well, unless you have anything else to add, if you want to plug your show, if you want to say anything, the floor is yours here, buddy.
I should have brought my Roy Rogers picture. I didn't even think about that. You know, we could sign off the way I sign off on my regular show. I'd sing Happy Trails for you, but we'd lose everybody before I finish, so I won't do that. but Happy Trails to you. Thank you so much for having me on the show. I appreciate that. It was an honor to be with you, Joe.
All right, Rick. Again, please keep it up. You're definitely doing the right thing. You can't ever stop doing this. And we listen to you every week. And thank you. And keep up the great work, please.
I appreciate that. Thank you. You too, Joe. Thank you.
All right. See you later, buddy.
Okay. So long.
Well, that was fun. Absolutely. You got to listen to him. Rick Jackson, Country Classics. If you want to listen to him, get the app Odyssey and look up KYGO Legends. KYGO Legends on the Odyssey app. And you can listen. And my cousin Tana, she just found out about that the other day, and she's listening now. But it's a lot of fun. Other than that, I will let you go, and you guys have a great Thanksgiving. I don't know if I'm going to do a show next week, but I will see you soon. All right.